Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Hi everyone, welcome to Be Good and Rewatch It. Good job, Natalie. Our rewatch podcast that it was supposed to be on another feed by now. It's not. We'll just say that was planned and not the result of just endlessly kicking the can down the road. This time we're watching our way through The Purge, a series. We made it through The Purge, The Purge Anarchy, The Purge Electioneer, and now the fourth film, The First Purge. Joining me to discuss that fourth film, Austin Walker.
Hey.
Rob Zachney.
Hey.
Natalie Watson.
Hey, hey.
Ooh. Whoa. Escalation.
Danielle Riendo.
Hey, hey, hey.
Wow.
Wow.
Three hays.
I'm impressed.
The three, you know? Hays.
People are on their Friday game right now, apparently.
Thank God. Made it through this week.
We did, yeah. No, yeah. We have. We've made it. And we made it through this series, which honestly, when we started talking about doing the Purge movies, I was the only one that had seen a significant chunk of them. And I had burned out on the third one in a way that was like, I'm good. I've rewatched all the Halloween movies, but you know what? I don't need a fourth Purge movie. And so we had originally talked about maybe not even doing a discussion of the fourth one. But then, like, we saw some details about, like, it was directed by someone different. That, you know, was this guy I'll get into, Gerard McMurray, who is doing some work with Jordan Peele on the Twilight Zone reboot. And it's like, you know, we've come this far. We might as well see the last one out. And so if you've listened to these before, know that we're going to spoil the entire movie up front. So we're not going to do a spoiler section or anything like that. But The First Purge, which released this summer, so it's a pretty recent film. It was set before the events of the other films. Like, as you can kind of surmise from the title, it is about the first sort of purge experiment. So the new founding fathers have emerged as a new third political party amidst like a really severe economic downturn. They managed to capture the presidency. Like, the series is like sort of ambivalent on like whether they did so with some shenanigans or not, but whatever the case, like, they now have the presidency and some sort of like significant election coalition. And in this movie, they partner with a psychologist who, how did Marissa Tomei find her way into this film?
Yep.
She shows up. Listen. And my wife goes, excuse me? Like, what is she doing in this movie? Not that, like, Marissa Tomei,
get
hey,
paid.
You want to come
took
be
a
in,
fucking turn.
Come be in some genre movies, like, that's fine. It just seems like, I don't know. It was a kind of a bit role that I was surprised she was in. Anyway, she plays a psychologist that wants to perform an experiment. She wants to sort of like test this sort of like psychological hypothesis that has been sort of like an underlying text to the Purge series about the justification of like people need to, people become better people if they can get their violent primordial urges out. And she essentially gets her experiment funded by the new founding fathers, who are looking for a way to spur economic activity through violence. Mm-hmm. And so Staten Island is picked to be the source of the first experiment. People are offered, you know, because this is an experiment, it's not like, hey, you have to stay here. So people are offered $5,000 if they choose to stay in Staten Island. They are offered undisclosed amounts of more money if they choose to sort of quote participate. The government doesn't sort of like mandate what that means, although, you know, wink and a nod. Some measure of people end up staying just because they're just not really sure what this is or aren't taking it like fully seriously. So a few key characters to run through. Skeletor a sort of like Freddy Krueger-like character who is sort of introduced at the start of the movie and kind of acts as sort of a through line, very like traditional slasher style villain that kind of haunts his way through the movie. He opens the film. He is portrayed as a drug addict who is excited about the notion of the purge and is actually the character who coins the term purge. Once he mentions that he's looking forward to purging, and then the government sort of picks up on that language.
White folks took rock and roll from us. They took the word the purge from us. I fucking swear, man.
And early on, Skeletor cuts the face of Isaiah, a young kid who's drug dealing to earn some cash and hasn't told his sister. His sister, Naya, is an early anti-purge activist. And then finally, sort of like connecting these threads is Dimitri, who's sort of a local drug kingpin who's kind of sticks around in Staten Island because he's worried rival gangs or even the local police will sort of make a move on their cash reserves under the guise of the purge. So one key thing that I mentioned earlier that I'll loop back into now is that this movie was scripted by James DeMonaco, who was the writer-director on the first three films, but he didn't direct it. But even to have like a writer through line for a horror series is like pretty unique. That is not usually how that stuff usually bounces between different creatives. And the first Purge was directed by Gerard McMurray, who was importantly, I think in the context of this film specifically, a producer on Fruitvale Station. The movie he directed was actually on Netflix. I haven't seen it. It's called Burning Sands. I guess it's a movie about extreme hazing that did well at Sundance. I don't know if that movie's any good or not, but that's part of why he got picked up by Blumhouse to direct this. And he's also going to be directing some episode in Jordan Peele's Twilight Zone reboot. So I think I'll open the floor on reactions, but I think, Rob, you're the first one to watch it. I think all of us came away surprised at the movie, at our reaction to the film. That's probably for reasons all over the map, but I'm curious, Rob, like what did you take away from it that was surprising that landed us all in a place where we were glad we actually took the time to see the series through to its conclusion so far?
Yeah, I mean, expectations were certainly low heading in, which I think helped this movie, and they certainly got lower when the movie opens on Skeletor, right? Like, my first reaction was very cringe when I saw the way this guy is depicted with very, like stereotypically, like, habitual drug abuser features, right? Like, the badly recessed and decayed gums, you know, exposed teeth. And then he's just a crazy murderous criminal who we meet. Very much like it is launching straight into, I think, a lot of stereotypes. And then there is also a degree of he's got like scarification markings all over his face, which like there are cultures where that are traditional. That's traditional, like tribal markings,
right?
And so there's something very like this is a black drug user, violent, and like all that's flashing in neon. And I was like, well, I hope this comes around. I think it
does. The movie know what it's playing with here?
Yeah, and I think what rescues it is that I grow increasingly over the course of the series less confident in DeMonaco's grip of the material he wants to work with. I grow increasingly convinced that he is very good at creating like a pastiche of other things that are familiar that he enjoys, but he is not necessarily great at creating them for himself. But I think what pulls this movie out a little bit is the people who are making it find a way to make a pretty good movie, right? I think one of the things I really like about this is it is speaking to one of the things that I think Austin mentioned with Election Year, this is a similarly community-grounded one, but even more so, I would say. Like, even the way it is shot is very familiar in terms of, like, the way it lays out the geography of a neighborhood, the rhythm of life sort of going on even on the eve of this purge. And I think the movie's much more interested in that. And it feels, at least, like it's much more led and influenced by the black director and actors who are making it. And so I feel like it's no longer weighed down by Frank Grillo's Punisher, stand-in yeah. or, you know, Christ-like Hillary Clinton figure. So that, I think, is a relief in this movie.
So I want to, like, to build on that and bring in some context. I was reading, and a link to this was a really good interview over at Slash Film with the director, in which I'm not going to sit here and reread the whole thing. I'll actually just drop this into our chat so people can look at it if they would like. But so, like, one of the things that the interviewer asks of the director, he says that Jason Blum has talked about doing a prequel about the first night of the Purge for a while. Did he have some specific ideas that he wanted to see? The question is, this is still James DeMonaco's world and he wrote the script. So what were you able to add to the world of the Purge? And I think this is, like, some of this is, like, really telling and interesting given our, like, through-line criticism of DeMonaco and what he's done in previous entries. And so the director says, I added a lot. More of the characters yeah. became people of color. The perspective of what I think is scary for a black man, the KKK, everything you see happen in the film, the masks, every part of it, I came in and really told James how I wanted to make my vision and tell it from a black perspective, make it young, contemporary, and fresh. It can still feel fun and talk about what's now from my perspective from the black and brown community. That's what I brought to it. Question, did the script not specify what masks people were wearing? No, it didn't specify masks at all. Did events like Charlottesville inform the script? Totally. When that happened, I said, we've got to do that. That's scary to anyone. It's scary in real life, but it's definitely scary to a black man or any person of color. So we had to do that. So it's just, like, interesting to see, like, the commentary that this director is making about, like the fact that he said more of the characters being people of color suggests that there's a version of this movie that has, like, similar problems to previous films and that, like, there are just, like, sort of random white people in here to sort because there are random white people in here and that the movie would be stronger if it was pulling at threads that, like, were alongside the mm-hmm. people of color in the movie. So, anyway, I just wanted to sort of set that up because I think that, like, paints, like, an interesting coloring of, like, what this director brought to this film that was different than the script and DeMonaco himself. So, Danielle, go ahead.
Yeah, speaking to that, I definitely felt something of a tension between the script and the actual sort of vision and the way it was actually put together. And I will say, like, just to start, I do think this is a much stronger and more coherent vision, for sure, especially than the last one. And I actually think it's a pretty good crystallization of what the Purge movies kind of want to be. So I do think it's closer. But I did absolutely sense a tension between James DeMonaco's script, which really feels like he read Gang Leader for a day and then felt like, all right, I want to make that into a Purge movie, which if you haven't read that book, it's sociologist Sudhir Venkatesh was in the 80s, actually went to a Chicago, a project, a housing project, and actually hung out with a gang leader and, like, learned the ins and outs of what sort of like a drug, you know, what a drug kingpin does. And he actually kind of hooked up with a, like, sexy, awesome leader guy who was both, you know, active in poisoning the community because he's, you know, selling crack, but also helping the community in certain ways, hosting, you know, things at community events and helping people in the community. And that is just, it feels like the character of Dimitri just came out of that book, like out of a white person's reading of that book. And so it is very much the glue that's kind of holding this together. I think the actual visuals and the visual language of the movie is successful and strong in this case, and especially having, like, no good white characters, no good, like, point of view characters, no, you know, hapless suburban couple or any bullshit like that that was in the sort of second movie. But it there are some portions of the script that do feel a little like, all right, it's still DeMonaco after all, for sure.
Yeah, definitely. I think, you know, I came away fairly surprised by the, especially by the back. I mean, I shouldn't have been surprised by the back half of the film because each of these films turns into an action movie by the final act. But there was a quality to this movie that actually reminded me of. So I've spoken in the past about how this series feels like something. I'm mad I didn't get to watch this in a theater with other black people on not just this one, but the Purge series in general on release night. This one felt like a different type of viewing experience than those, right? Which is, it struck me as being almost it's obviously a horror film, but it also at parts feels like a love letter to martial arts cinema, to blaxploitation, especially the, like, the drug dealer with the heart of gold character is not only something that you see in Gang Leader or in The Wire. Like, obviously, I think Gilan Noel does a great job as Dimitri, but he's like doing his best D'Angelo Barksdale in certain scenes, like 100%. The like watch the eyes, Terrence. Like the like coaching basketball sequence is just ripped from The Wire. And I think Alan does like a fantastic job as this character. Like in terms of just having screen presence and having. There are times when I watch TV and a movie actor shows up and I'm like, oh no, like you're just a different class of actor than the rest of these people on TV. And that's not a diss. Like it's hard to be an actor. This was the opposite, which is Alan has years of being a TV actor under his belt and being like, and TV is in a different place than what it was in the past. And so like he just commands the room whenever he's in any scene. But I keep seeing these things that felt like old Shaw Brothers martial arts movies or like. There are bits that remind me of Kenji Misumi's work, which is like Lone Wolf and Cub or Zatoichi. These like Japanese samurai movies in which there are these hyper stylized bad guys that have very interesting masks and very specific weapons and very like stylish action sequences that are also these films are like so big in the black community, like coming up in the age group that the director did, like, I know you watch martial arts movies as a kid, my guy. Like, I'm there with you. And so, like, when the two women are walking around with, like, the baby bombs, like, these are just the assassins that came for the dad in Shogun Assassin. Like, they really are. And that ended up feeling like there was this other underlying style of film that ended up coming through here. And I really appreciated that because it wasn't something I expected at all. And that's, like, on top of all the stuff you've already set up, which is the fact that this film felt like it was community first and felt like it was about a group of people. This is kind of echoing what I said last time, but, like, when you have an primarily black and brown cast, it gives you the room to not be playing in raw stereotype. I still think Skeletor still bums me out because, like, there's a version of that character who the lesson, the takeaway is that society failed him. I think there's a little bit of that in the sense that, like, this movie opens with him talking to a doctor, and that doctor is someone who should be like, yo, we need to get you, like, assistance, and we need to get you – sorry, someone was coming into this room. Joel, we're recording, Joel. Go away. Fuck off. Joel is, like, trying to come in this room. And so I think that there's like a version of that character who there's someone who points to the fact that like people like Skeletor are already the victims of a system that has wanted to get rid of certain types of people for a long time.
Yeah, like if Naya had found out that what Isaiah was doing was going and finding Skeletor, I could have like seen a scene there where Naya's like, you don't understand like what created
like that dude's
Skeletor.
Fucked up, obviously, yeah. But yeah. Like there are situations that lead to that.
Yeah.
Like the drug war in this country, the lack of actual services for people, the lack of mental health services for poor folks, for black folks. Like that stuff leads to the creation of this supervillain of Skeletor, this horror villain. And I don't want the movie where Skeletor is saved. Do you know what I mean? Like that's not the thing that I'm looking for here.
Yeah.
Like I
especially
know
especially because the director like explicitly like also in this interview says like I wanted a black Freddy Krueger.
Totally.
And I put him in this movie. Like he says like he grew up on Nightmare on Elm Street and he's like I consider this. He's like I don't ever see black. Slasher villains, and
totally.
I wanted one, so this is mine. And like, I think part of the way he gets away with it is what you're saying is the idea that if that was one of the primary black characters in this film, then it's completely fucked by having a whole range of characters. Like, yes, maybe they could have done more with it, but it doesn't stand out nearly as much because you have a much wider palette that you're playing with.
I will say I wish there were other drug users in this movie, though, because, like, there is a range of drug use, and most of it is not you then become a killer. Like, bulk of people who are using drugs in this country around the world are not, like, one law away from killing people.
Well, it's interesting because the two girls that, like, are sent to assassinate Dimitri, are, like, doing a bunch of blow, like, right before they, like, hype themselves up to, like...
Be assassins. Also characters...
Also,
go ahead.
Yeah, that whole action sequence was so stylized. Like, it wasn't, like, to girls who had no experience with combat.
No, that's
like,
what I'm saying.
They were like
ninja assassins. Yeah. This is what I'm saying. Yeah. Stuff like that is straight from like the martial art, the 70s martial arts
and
playbook.
The smoke sequence. Was, like, with
we gotta talk about that.
We'll get there. But once
even
yeah.
Dimitri's ability to counter, like the way he he's like, oh, I know how to counter this, and I was like, what the fuck is going in a good way?
Don't fuck with Dimitri, my guy.
It was great.
Brazilian jiu-jitsu.
True.
That's what it is.
That's
what he should have been teaching. That would have actually been dope. If he was like secretly running MMA gyms.
Yeah.
Oh.
They show a tiny bit of boxing. And
okay,
I was like,
you're
yeah,
right.
yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
But then, yeah.
The thing with Skeletor that was so interesting to me is that he wasn't cast as like ostracized to the community. Like
right.
he was, like when he showed up to the party scene yeah. and everyone was like, what's up?
Yo, what's good? Skeletor's here. Now it's a real party.
I was like, what the fuck? Yeah. I was absolutely intending everyone to like move away from him, but instead like people gravitate towards him. Like people are
he
like,
he was
directly...
grinding.
He was grinding.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, he Listen. Was grinding. And, but what I mean is like, it was just interesting to me that choice was made to not like other this person in that like he was othered in other ways in the sense that you know like his visage and his like physical appearance was like so stark and so in contrast to the people around him, but in terms of like his participation in the community, like he was like accepted and like welcomed into the party scene, which I don't really know what to make of that, but it was just an interesting choice to me.
To me, that felt in line with the fact that like the expectations of the new Founding Fathers are just wrong, right? Like I've been actually beating this drum about the state of nature over and over again this week. I'm not going to go deep into it here, but like the idea that people are fundamentally going to be afraid and violent without the laws that society has built for them. Mm-hmm. is built on certain suppositions. And this film introduces very briefly the idea that sometimes those suppositions and those models and those statistics are not trustworthy, mm-hmm. right? Again, like I don't want to like jump ahead in the plot, but like that is brought up pretty cleanly. Like, mm-hmm. hey, wait a second. You said my model said that this would happen given the socioeconomic group. And then later the Marissa Tomei character even follows up and says, you know, you said you're doing this for X reason. Can we even trust those? Can we even trust that
yeah.
reason? Or are you just trying to get rid of these people, basically?
Yeah.
I think, like to that point about community, I think what really interested me here is that, and this is where I start to really like the movie much more than Election Year. Like when we talked about Election Year, I was really troubled by the degree to which it flirted with like respectability politics mm-hmm. and kind of like gave a big, you know, cosign to like small business owners, people lifting up the community with entrepreneurship.
you built this.
And,
yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And what's interesting to me is in this movie, this movie nods at that stuff, but it actually doesn't endorse them. And actually, I think it basically subverts them in a lot of ways. Like the movie sets up early on that like, Naya is playing a very familiar archetype here. It's the idealistic young woman whose job it is both to try to like appeal to the better angels of the gangster
with a dark past.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yep. Who she is also like still totally in love with. So it's very
he's
like
so hot.
I have written in my
he's
notes.
Incredibly hot.
I swear to fucking God, if they kiss right now, like I was
yeah.
like. Don't do this.
But
he's very
no,
hot.
No, but do it.
He's very hot.
He's very hot.
But the thing is, so
he has that chain. He has that high fucking sweater.
I know. When he kept removing each layer, I was like, here it goes.
When he's running shirtless,
like a nesting doll of hot. But
so she's
there being like, you know. Are you taking out of the community or are you giving back to it? And she's very much like, her whole purge plan is like, everyone should go to the church. And now part of what this movie is setting up is also tapping into the anxieties that have always centered on what if the black church is not a refuge? What if it is a place that becomes as it has often historically been, what if it becomes a place
as it was targeted 2 weeks ago, right?
Yeah.
So
So it is tapping into those anxieties, but also it's shown that like the people in that church, they're kind of fed up with the pastor. They're yeah. like he's fucking boring. Like we're tired of this shit. And you got Dimitri there, and he's sort of foregrounded as the three wise men in the neighborhood, the elders, who are these shit kicking old dudes who sit in their lawn chairs and just like, you know, talk shit about people, but also are mentors. They also sort of again hint at a kind of respectability politics, but they're down with Dimitri. They're cool with him.
Yeah.
But they also tell young Isaiah, who is initially presented as dressed up, you know, all clean cut, wearing his suit, ready to go on job interviews or to the prep school.
Got his coffee.
And that's all a front for Naya, who doesn't really know what the hell is going on. Doesn't really, like, hasn't, like, she's an activist, but she's got a lot of blind spots. And Dimitri, I don't think, is ever really presented. I'm not sure Dimitri has a lesson he needs to learn from this, because basically in the arc of this movie, he's vindicated, right? Like, yeah. the power bases he built are the yeah. ones that endured. And I think that's an interesting part in this movie, is that, like, where election year was basically, like, we got to pay attention to politics and, you know, get our shit together and run our own businesses. This is much more like, actually, there's a lot of people who may want our community to remain virtuously poor and helpless. Right. And maybe you can only trust your fists.
You know? You got to punch fascists is the takeaway for me. I will say, building on that, like, you're right. Like, the three wise men own a business. There's a point at which they say, well, Isaiah should come work with us if he needs a job. But we never see the business. And I think that's intentional. Like, it never wants to valorize the workplace. It never wants to say, if only you got a job. There are sequences in which even Naya is like, I get why someone would take the 5Gs to say they would participate. And so I think there's a lot done to try to, like, keep the material ways in which the respectability politics would seem like the virtuous option off the screen. I will say that sometimes this goes far in the other direction, which is Staten Island. So there's the big influx in the middle of the movie of killers who are being brought in, who are basically being shipped in, overseas mercenaries, and presumably some local mercenaries too. But, like, two things. One, those masks came out of nowhere. Motherfuckers had those masks on hand. And two, there's something really fascinating happening with the way the contacts work in this movie. So, as you set up, Patrick, people could agree to join the purge. And if they'd agreed to participate, they would wear these contacts that lit up. Or that's the thing that happens. They light up in these bright colors. And I think, one, that's super effective in terms of having this, like, very sharp contrast between purgers and non-purgers. It's also just, like, it turns it into a horror movie, because seeing people with lights in their eyes across...
When Isaiah's going down that fucking alley?
Yeah. It's creepy as shit. It's, like, genuinely scary. Yeah. But also, it weirdly others anyone who took that five grand, because you have to wear that to get it.
But you only have to wear...
If you're participating?
No, yeah. So you have to only get 5,000 to stay.
Gotcha.
And the tracking device is to keep you that you the tracking sure device for stay. The 5K.
Gotcha.
But when you put the lenses in, that's to record your participation. So that's what makes that sequence so effective, is cuz, like, all those people are people who have said, I'm out here to participate,
I'll kill
people. Right?
Yeah,
but most of them aren't. Right? Most of them are still, for the most part, are like, I'm going to stay inside and just look creepy out the window. Because it's hard to commit to, like, people aren't ready to, like, kick down the door and go beat people up and kill them.
Instead they're, you know, like having bonfires in the street or, you know, like, there's other... That when everybody was asking, what about all the other illegal shit you could be doing during a purge? Like, that's what people were inclined to do.
Finally, we can just grill out and nobody's going to shut it down.
Yeah. Honestly, yeah. That's
the block party.
Multiple block parties. They're like, there's three parties on the island, sir.
And the dude's like,
sir, it's extremely lit out there. We don't know what's happening. Everyone is extremely turnt.
This is, I think... I actually do, like, again, like, this movie, like, plays up caricatures, but this entire this entire bullshit experiment. Like, Marissa Tomei is such a bad scientist. It's so
she's
good.
She's terrible.
But it's so good. She's an idealistic crap scientist. She's basically like, I believe in the integrity of my race science, and we are going to do a serious study. Now, I believe my theory, and I haven't read all the literature on this, but I believe I know what I'm talking about, is there is no such thing as community within minority poor communities. And if we let, if we treat them like animals and let them out of their cages, they will consume each other. And what happens instead is like, wait, there is a community. These people just want to hang out. Like what happens? Like, you can do whatever the fuck you want. It's basically like, all right, let's crank the music.
So it's Friday?
And party. Yeah.
It's Friday, and we all got $5,000 for staying here. We are going to throw the best party ever.
And the New Founding Fathers people are like, ah, what? Like, this is, who could have seen this coming? This is not what D.W. Griffith told me was going to happen.
I've read the bell curve.
There's a lot to dig in. We'll dig into this specific point because I think this is like a turning point in the movie. There's a lot to kind of get into, and we'll get to you, Danielle. So let's take a quick break, and we'll come back and talk about sort of this turning point in the film.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
All right, Danielle, I know you had your hand up, but it's something you wanted to say.
Yeah, I just want to go off that point a tiny bit as what I thought was the most Trump-era part of this movie, because this is the first one made entirely after the last election, right? I believe so.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, cool. So obviously there is a moment of a literal pussy grabbing, and that is like a very, very Trumpian thing. But I thought, like, in terms of the sort of, we can maybe talk about that later. But I thought in terms of the actual sort of text in the movie and the slight subtext of the movie, the most Trumpian thing about the whole thing, other than obviously the like piece of shit NFFA politician, was that there's a white lady who's going along with it. She's going along with it, and then she ends up kind of getting screwed. It's almost like the dumbass white lady who votes for Trump, the dumbass white lady who votes, or it kind of throws in with the shitty, bad Republicans who are obviously not here for great reasons. She's believing the science. She's believing the bullshit. She's believing all of this, and then ends up, of course, getting killed in a parking lot,
She thinks they're enabling her.
Right.
Right.
Exactly.
That's an important right. She's like career climbing. She's going to make a name for herself.
Yeah, exactly. Like, this is like, she was like,
she's going to be Olympia Snow.
She was like, I'm thankful to the NFA for like doing this for me. Like, this is like in her service where.
Yes.
Yeah.
It really is not, my dude.
It taps into this like history again of like, minority groups, minority communities being targeted for just like whatever the fuck experiments that somebody with connection to the government wants to run, right? This tradition we have of really bad and really like racist and instrumentalized social science being turned against communities. And I think she stands very effectively for that, where like on some level, like she believes her intentions are good. She's just serving science and reason, and that's what she's doing this for. And what this is perverse, but on some level she's like, you know, I think we really need to run an experiment to see if we can just get everyone in a minority community just to kill each other for a night. I think that's the only way we can answer that question.
Even when like isn't she the one that like at some point says the line like, oh wait, do you just want these people to kill it? You would just want to eradicate a certain sex? Like, she doesn't even... She looks at... Like she's the villain, but then turns and goes, oh, that's what you want to use this for. Like, no, like, that is the experiment.
Oh, damn, leopards really do love faces.
God, what? Damn, true.
God, yeah.
Can I ask you a question, Danielle, since you brought up the pussy grabbing scene? The literal, there's a sequence in which, you've seen the sequence if you've seen the movie by now, but there's a sequence in which a character is sexually assaulted briefly, but it's a very awkward to watch and very uncomfortable sequence, yeah. Because it makes it is framing the action of someone grabbing at yeah. Naya, it's one instance in the film in which the way in which women are treated is like primarily via violence. Lots of women get shot in this movie. There's a handful of other women characters besides Naya. Another woman in the tower that she's in, who goes to church with her, a mother and a daughter. Mm-hmm. And those characters are treated with like a degree of agency and care, and like they're in it to the end, and they're going out to look for each other, and they're trying to take care of their family and blah blah blah. Mm-hmm. But most of the background women characters in this movie, there's a character who works with Dee, I forget what her name is, because she has like Blaze.
Yeah.
Who has like two lines and is like set up to be his like killer, like his like most devout soldier.
Yeah.
It's like his Snoop from The Wire.
Exactly, Snoop.
Right?
Yeah.
And then there's like a woman who hangs with the three wise men. Mm-hmm. And then there's a couple of other women here or there that are all just like shot super quickly. With very little character development, without like even the kind of surface level character development that the three wise men get or something.
Also,
I'm just curious about how you felt about that. So, and then the two prostitutes who get killed, the sex workers.
Well, I know you're asking Danielle.
Sorry. Yeah, but I'm asking everyone. We're asking the panel. But Danielle, if you have an answer first, and then we can.
Yeah.
Yeah, totally. I thought this was pretty weird. You know, sort of, I think maybe one of the better treatments of this was in that second movie that sort of showed, you know, the woman character, the waitress who, you know, deals with sexual like harassment all day, every day. And then it escalates to full on assault with that character in the second movie. Like that was actually a better handling of this sort of thing than the literal pussy grabbing. Like this felt like it was a setup to a joke.
Yeah.
It felt like a setup to like, oh, here's how we can do a funny Trump joke that is like, you know, the pussy grabs back kind of thing. And obviously she's a badass. Naya is like considered a badass. She's going out there. She's doing the thing. Like she might be naive in a lot of ways, but she is like a badass character who gets shit done in this movie. Absolutely. And the fact that this sort of happens to her feels a little flippant. Like it does feel like it is just the setup for that joke and like, oh, they're going to take a dump on Trump. But it's like, yeah, but you also use this awesome character who does have a lot of agency to just kind of like be a punchline for something. And she ends up gets away, right? She kicks the guy or whatever and gets away. And so it's like, you know, not seen as like as traumatic as it could have been in this context. Mm. Like if a person actually really was grabbing you and really could bring you down to the like literal underground, he was like in a grate or something. I remember this being like really weirdly framed and like kind of weirdly shot as well. But yeah, I don't think this was very successful. Like, if you want to do a Me Too moment, absolutely, like, go for it, movie. I think this movie is actually sort of, like, working towards some things in a more subtle way than, obviously, the last three movies was. But, yeah, this felt very flippant and shitty and, like, oh, don't use her like that. Don't just use this character like this. She is obviously a survivor in a lot of other ways. And, like, if you're going to make her a survivor of sexual assault, like, can you be a little less goofy about it? Like this was just a joke, you know? Like this didn't feel great to me.
Yeah. I agree with that. First of all, she's like caught in a trap and then like
pulled
towards them, and they have like baby masks on, and so there's like this weird like what lures her is like the sound of babies crying, which is like such a like, oh, playing on motherly instinct. And that's also like something that I've been told before. Like I remember like my mom telling me, like, if you hear babies crying outside, just call the police. Like don't go out and check, because like people will use like baby recordings to like lure women outside because they like go to see what's wrong.
Oh my God.
I remember my mom telling me that from like the youngest age. And I don't really know where she got that from. But anyway, so the thing with the background, like in the instances where women are killed in this movie, Blaze is seen as like a super like highly competent fighter and like super highly competent in combat, and yet when she is killed, she is like killed by a drone in which she like there's like she's just like it's like a firing squad on like all of Dimitri's crew, and then he's like left alone, which fucking sucked because like I know that if it had been like her one-on-one, like there would at least have been like if the plot is to kill Blaze, like give Blaze like a fighting chance, do you know what I mean? And like the other the even
Blaze of Glory,
even the like the absolute background characters that I remember in the scene where they're like going from floor to floor, in which like the militia, the hired mercenaries that have been, they go floor to floor in the Park Hill building, which is like the center of the community. It is called the center of the community by everyone on TV and in the program, because these are the housing projects they want to target and effectively clean out. I remember seeing this one scene just like stuck in my head so aggressively, where they're like it's shot like down a hallway, and there's a woman in the far back left apartment, and she's like shooting a gun like she doesn't know how to shoot a gun, because why would any of these people be like, you know what I mean? Like it's like she's just like flailing, like throwing shots out just to like distract or like just push away sort of this like huge force coming at her. And it was like the saddest thing just to see like the absolute vulnerability of the background character, you know.
That sequence is terrifying. Like we've seen a lot of Purge. We've seen a lot of people get killed in the Purge movies.
Yeah.
But like the militia, the like KKK militia, the like Nazi. It's actually that's the Nazi.
That's like the Gestapo jacket.
With like black face masks on. Yeah. I don't know if y'all like read that right, but like okay.
Well, he strangled. Dimitri ends up strangling a guy in blackface.
Yes,
I was
totally.
Wearing gorilla masks.
Gorilla masks and blackface masks and like minstrel show cartoon caricature masks. Those scenes of them moving from floor to floor and killing people, and the ways in which the claustrophobic ways in which those hallways are shot, the way in which the bodies lie on the floor, the way that like Dimitri checks for like pulse on people, it was like really frightening in a way that just seeing like, oh, this is a sniper on a roof. This is like, these are killers in a car, like cackling, like so much less terrifying than, or even in Election Year, which had a specific kind of like neo-Nazi mercenary band, nowhere near as scary as them moving through the tower.
Yeah.
This is, sorry.
No, I was just going to say it like, I don't, it's like, yesterday hearing the news of the mass shooting in Thousand Oaks and then watching that scene like that night was just like, that's like the vulnerability that is like so extremely terrifying. Yeah. And like go ahead, Rob.
Yeah. This is where I actually really start to think this movie's extremely clever and smart. And this is where the movie fully won me over. It was the way different violences are depicted.
Yeah.
So you'll note the militia and these paramilitary goons are all very like stay frosty, tactical, go code, hand signals. And that is how like professional like military, like professional combat forces operate. But it is also shit that's become fetishized by the right.
They're fucking
like,
LARPing.
Right, like, the right loves this shit. When they're fucking, like, figuring out DDoS attacks on a website, they're still on fucking 4chan being like, all right, this is Operation Vengeful Pikachu, and we are rallying at 1400 GMT. Synchronize your... And it's all this bullshit.
Synchronize and your Swatch clocks.
Right, and then you see, like, the fucking 3% militia fucking, like, cosplay Minutemen pieces of shit at Charlottesville, and they're, like, all, like... And they're all, like, tooled up, like, in tactical gear, and they all use the same fucking, like, you know, doggerel, like, you know, mil-speak, basically, that they only sort
link
of
up.
Know.
Yeah. Yeah, uh-huh.
And so we see them operating that way throughout this movie. And then when Dimitri and his crew roll up, And then, like, some of them are, like, combat veterans, by the way. Like, the movie's also dealing with the fact that, like, this country's been at war with it for a long fucking time. And, like, you know, much as in Vietnam did in a previous generation, there's a lot of people filtering back into different communities with, like, military experience. But his crew has the gear. They have a lot of that understanding and language. But when they take on that group of killers who are going after the wise men, they pop smoke, and it's this cool shot where all these fucking, like, Klansmen vanish into the smoke. But then the violence is pure martial art. It's cartoonish. You got guys dual wielding,
like,
and doing gun katas.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's actually a blood splatter on the screen, which is, like, clearly, like, done through CGI. And it's, like, deliberately, like, no, we want the blood to go through, like,
the blood is, like,
the
super
lens.
Colorized, like, super saturated, like, super cartoony. Yeah.
And I think what this movie smartly does is it refuses to fetishize the type of violence that is employed by the U.S. military and like tactical teams in police forces. It refuses to fetishize the type of people who roll out to Ferguson protests. It refuses to fetishize the type of violence that, like, the 3% militia is enamored of. When the black characters, when Dimitri's gang fights back, it is valorous, stylized combat. And then it does something else, which I find interesting. That entire gang does get shot down like they're nothing. They're massacred by drones. And that scene, you can't not, like, I cannot see that scene without thinking about, like, the United States deploys drone violence on a massive level against vulnerable people around the world. And this is what makes that scene extra horrifying, is that we know these are people who are just, like, out there for the community. They're just people. And they're brave and they're courageous, and we've just seen that. And it
and
doesn't
competent.
Fucking matter.
They're competent.
Yeah.
And it doesn't matter because of the asymmetry of conflict.
Mm-hmm. Right. They get you see the gun cam video, the gun cam footage, they get painted, and then they're all massacred in seconds, and Dimitri's alone. And I think that this is a series that, like, has been critical of violence, but also, like, plays fast and loose with it. This is the first of this series that I think articulates through its depiction of violence a worldview and an argument. Mm-hmm. And that's when I was fully on, like, oh yeah, First Purge. Like, you know what's up.
First Purge.
Yeah, it's supporting that.
Oh, go ahead.
Just super briefly. I believe it's around that sequence where there are a bunch of people cosplaying as cops.
Mm-hmm.
There's a bunch of, like, right-wingers cosplaying basically as, like, militarized cops.
In a baseball stadium with the national anthem.
All American.
Like, mm-hmm. playing.
Right, yeah, Rob, is your thought, those are just the police?
I don't. Yeah, my reading on that was that wasn't cosplay. That was a bunch
just
of
cops.
Like, motorcycle cops who, like, they love their little, like, fucking white helmets and
aviator
mirror shades. Like, fuck those guys. But, like, literally, like, that cop, like, was the cop who ran my neighborhood in Cambridge when I first moved there. Like, literally, I saw that cop, like, day after day, like, fucking screaming at people in traffic stops. That's who the local police were for me. So I saw that scene. I'm like, that's probably not cosplay. That's probably...
just cops.
That's probably, yeah, a bunch of guys from the precinct.
Fair, yeah.
Which is...
door. Sorry.
Go for it.
Yeah.
Which is, like, it points to... There was one point in which the news people were like, look at these people. They're in masks. Like, they don't want to be identified. Whereas, like, the cops are, if we are to read them as, like, actual cops, they're wearing their badges, like, they are, like, emboldened enough to be completely on display, if we're, like, reading them as actual cops. And also when the news people are talking about people wearing masks, they're talking about the mercenaries that were hired to come in were predominantly the people wearing masks. That were, like, committing actual murder, whereas like the other people wearing masks in the community that were, like, committing crimes were not actually, like, it was more. There was one point where they ask, like, "Is this in celebration of, or is this, like, a mask of identity?"
Yeah,
well, that's
even.
It was interesting.
I just had a question. Like, what do you make of the two? I want to call them, like, like bomber aunties.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Because like they're painted as so sinister and menacing, but I'm pretty sure that they didn't actually try to hurt anybody. They're just fucking with people.
They're fucking with people. They're like pranksters.
Yeah.
Well, one of my first things, okay, first of all, I read them as nurses at first, which they're not. I think it was just, they had
their patients.
Okay, but look, they had like scrub style clothing on. And so that opening sequence of them being interviewed, here's the reason I read it that way, is the doctor's like, would you be interested in hurting people? And then one of them is like, what do you think, doctor? And I read that as like workplace pushback. Like, yeah, doc, I work with you every day. What do you think? You think I want to hurt somebody? Huh? And so that like, so I have all these notes and like, how did these nurses even make bombs? Which... they're not nurses, to be clear. I recognize. Who knows? I have to look at the cast list. Maybe it says Auntie Nurse One, Auntie Nurse Two.
Oh, I'm gonna look that up.
But
right now,
the thing that's wild is like they answer what happened, how everybody has weird bombs and traps and all that. The NFFA has been like secretly seeding weapons to people, bombs and cheap guns and all sorts of weird
and all
shit.
All the equipment that Dimitri uses is from the
NFFA.
From
them, 100%, totally. So I don't know what to make of them because on one hand, they feel like they belong in Batman working for like Batman the Animated Series working for the Joker. They're definitely part of like the Joker's gang. But I don't know. Like, I guess I'm okay with them. I guess I was fine
with
them.
It's a weird, like,
that
the
sequence
tonal
is strange.
Shit. The tone. Yeah, it doesn't fit within stylistically or tonally the rest of the movie. Like, that stuff feels like more reminiscent of like the Mad Max weirdness that always creeps into the other films, and that always seems to be part of like DeMonico's like bit of how he's going to depict how people are going to act on this night. Whereas like this director seems to have come in and like let's actually personalize how people would act, and is like his most important like bit of change to the script and what's depicted on screen. And that bit seemed, I mean, it's hard to know, like, you know, we will never fully know like where things individually came from, but that sure feels like a DeMonico sort of like flourish. At the same time, like, it sounds like Skeletor was, you know, a Freddy Krueger character that this guy wanted to do. So it wouldn't surprise me if he's like, hey, I wanted to put in some weird horror-y stuff, and like, this is just an idea I had, and this series kind of floats between tones in a way that it's just flagrant about. And it's a one-off scene that disappears very quickly. I found it amusing, especially once you realize that, yeah, they were basically just firecrackers, and like the guy skates through just fine. But it's weird because it's the only time I think something like that happens, right? Like, there's not another instance where something is played for laughs.
There's another one. There's the guy with the water gun.
Oh, you're like, right.
Yeah.
Oh, you're
there's
right.
There's the guy with the water gun. I feel like this, the pussy grab, the water
even
gun.
Even the ATM guy, right? Like, there's a range of responses to there's no rules tonight. Some people are going to be pranksters. Some people are going to try to steal some money.
Some people are
going to
fuck on a car.
Some people are going to fuck on a car.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
What was I going to say?
Got you thinking about pranksters, and now you're distracted.
That's what it is. Tricksters.
Go ahead, Rob.
I guess I had a question about the women who set up the firecracker trap. My reading of that was also kind of that one of the things they articulate, one of their grievances, is that people like think they're jokes, they're kind of ignored by everybody. Mm. And like, to me, like, look, you live in a city, there are people who like are on the margins or living rough, and like your neighborhood probably has a few people whose like possessions are carried around in a shopping cart.
Yeah.
And those people do tend to be treated like they are obstacles, like they are invisible, like they are part of the backdrop of a community, but like in a lot of cases not really part of its life. And I think maybe what that scene is meant to depict is like there's this instinctive fear people have of like, ooh, like these people like will mean to do me harm, right? They have so little and they're scary and they seem a little unbalanced. You know, I'm terrified of them. And I think what they end up doing is they're kind of playing into that stereotype. Like, look, we know you don't like us. We know we scare you, but also like, we think it's funny. Like, right. we refuse to just be ignored that way. Like, if you're going to fear us, like, we're going to show you like, there's more here than you think. And we're going, like, I'm not sure I have a fully, like, articulated position, but that's what my feeling for what they're standing in for is, like, trying to get at.
There's, like, a politics of attention happening here, right? That's, like, it's so easy 99% of your days to just ignore us, to like ignore that we are living like hand to mouth, that we do not have a home, or mm-hmm. that, you know, to the degree that we have one, it is deeply unstable and could fall apart at any moment. Mm-hmm. Likewise with the guy with the water pistol, right? Which is like, yeah, look, at any time this could happen. This is not a special thing for the purge night. Someone could come grab you anytime. Mm-hmm. And put you against the wall and hold the gun up to you. You could get stuck up whenever. And there is something interesting about it being like, and on tonight, you're going to pay attention to it. Tonight, it won't just be a statistic. Tonight, we won't just be like the two women with the shopping carts. Like, you're going to remember us tomorrow. They don't necessarily pay that off here because that's kind of the last scene with them, right?
They don't come up again.
Yeah. So, no.
The thing that I thought about, or that I was going to mention earlier, is there's been a theme throughout all four of these movies of like childlikeness or childness in relationship with violence, with explicit violence, but it's treated in so many different ways, which is like, I don't really know what to like. In the first movie, it's like super sexualized, and like the girls are like dressed up in like super like little girls like sleeping gowns, and they're like, you know, doing like Ring Around the Rosie and like skipping around and like singing and on the swings and stuff. And in the other movies too, it's like super sexualized and like you know, the girls that show up to the corner store owners that are like, mm-hmm. hey, old man, like super.
I want my candy.
Yep. Like, yeah. And it's like very like, I'm trying to like parse the this like this.
I think you're looking for something that doesn't exist.
No, but in this one, it's used again because the old ladies have like teddy bears and stuff like that, and like it's like a silly thing now. Like now it's like, oh, look how silly it is that like we're planting this stuff all around, and we're like you know, our old lady attachment to these teddy bears is like seen as like disturbed or like, you know, like strange, and now it is like it is something that, like you're saying, like made to be paid attention to. But I don't think it's nothing because it's in every single fucking movie, and I don't know if it's just like trying to like kind of like edgy like kids violence like little like.
babies.
I guess I don't think it's like particularly deep. Like I'm not sure that DeMonico has like. Like, other than like maybe the thematic reading that you're getting into, which is like maybe it's just edgy and it's weird.
Yeah.
I just think it's like meant to be edgy and weird. Like, I don't think there's like a, and I'm trying to say something.
No,
like,
yeah.
Like the if anything, like one of the great like criticisms I have of like the lack of theming is around the personas, right? Like the personas are like just very shallow and boring and just what looks weird and strange, or Mad Maxian, which is what happens in the second and third films. And there could have been a lot more done with like what personas would people adopt if they did choose to like embrace this idea of anonymity. And that becomes like a trope or central to the notion of the purge, is that you don't go out as yourself. You go out as a persona, and the movie doesn't really, it introduces it because masks are weird and like the kid thing is creepy, and that's a horror trope, as opposed to like actually wrestling with that as like a thematic through line through the films. Rob?
But that's exactly what's going on here, though, I think, personally. This visual language is such a trope, right? It is such a horror trope. Teddy bears, animated dolls. There's an entire, you know, subgenre of horror that's like animated dolls and fucked up dolls and
hell
fucked
yeah,
up marionettes and that kind of thing. And I think it's playing into that. Like, whether or not DeMonico is like specifically, you know, using that super intentionally, it's still like using that visual language, right? It's still sort of like going off of those tropes. It's still sort of using that sort of, okay, things that are childlike, things that are supposed to be comforting or remind you of your childhood being subverted in a particular way, in a creepy or fucked up way, is like a very, I think even the masks go into that, right? Oh, make believe, you know, the whole idea of other personas and make believe and playing as something else. And it's like, it, again, here just used as sort of a horror trope, but I think there's something there for sure, Natalie. Like, I think that is, like, whether intentional or not, I think a very, like, strong sort of visual metaphor for what's going on here.
there is a contrast in each of these films. Like, I actually think there is something going on here, not in the sense that DeMarco, I keep saying DeMarco every episode. DeMarco has like a chart where he's like, this and this.
Yeah.
But the thing that the missing puzzle piece for me is that each of these films does strongly also have a through line about parenting and about children and about the whether like the pureness of the child.
Mm-hmm.
The first film, obviously, the kind of moral heart of it is the son,
mm-hmm.
And his childlike behavior is like weird. Is like he's like a goth kid.
Yeah.
He tells like creepy stories and builds little creepy robots. But the creepiness there is like pales in comparison to the women outside who are pretending to be children. And in general, the way The Purge is pitched throughout the series is that it's connecting us to our roots as animals. It's like our pure id-like, childlike state is one of hurting people and taking what we want and being in tune with that. And like the sex drive is also part of that same id thing. And so I think that's why those two things get framed together.
Totally.
But through the first Purge, through the Purge,
yeah.
through Purge Anarchy, where it's the relationship between the mother, the daughter, and the Holy Ghost. The mother, the daughter, and the Punisher, the character.
He's the Holy Ghost. Yeah.
Is also, again, the focal point and whether or not she can be protected and what her relationship is to both of them.
Mm-hmm.
And then in election year, we don't have a literal – I mean, one, we do have Charlie Rowan in the very beginning as a child having the purge happen to her family. But also we have just the relationship between
Marcus.
The bodega owner and his, like, protege, who is not a child but is his – is his protege. There is a father-son relationship there.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that stuff, that's like, there is something about what does being good in the world of The Purge partially means learning to deal with your id when you are a child, finding ways to build stuff and create stuff in the original Purge, or like there's sequences in the first Purge in which both Dee and Naya talk about their youth when they were even more violent, and Dee talks about watching Isaiah grow up, and like he isn't built for this. There's a lot of work being done about what it means to have a good childhood and the ways in which that can present you to the world or bring you to the world where you're prepared to live through a purge night or to own a business or to be a family member, depending on which entry in the series you're watching. So I think it's in there. I just don't think it stands on it. It's not its own thing. I think it connects to that, and in each movie says something a little bit different, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Yeah.
Oh, go ahead, Rob.
No, I was just gonna say, like, you kind of get to the final turn for where Marissa Tomei exits this. We talked about it a little bit, but she realizes that, like, basically her experiment failed, right? Like, the science such as it is that she based her fucking purge experiment on is debunked within hours of this thing starting.
She gets one murder from Skeletor,
who's a plant,
which is then. Yeah, which is then like sent out over social media, and like I guess this is all being
on the news.
Can I, you know, really briefly say that every time Skeletor kills someone, he's like, "Pay me more."
Pay me
so
more.
It feels like there is an incentive to kill more. Like there is a monetary incentive that
they
more
say that explicitly. They just don't explain what the
they don't say if it's $50
like,
or another $5,000 or what. But they say like for every you'll get paid more for more participation.
Okay, I see.
For sure, 100%.
Yeah.
Which, again, I think speaks to the thing, right? Which is, like, this is someone who is so far off of the – like, there's no way in which Skeletor – at the point at which Skeletor is in his life, he has been abandoned by society.
Yeah.
Like, this seems super appealing for someone like this, mm-hmm. right? Pay me more.
Yeah.
But – so then the killings start to escalate because now there are these groups that, like, we know from the ground-level point of view characters – basically, they're importing mercenaries and the clan into this community to start slaughtering people. And Marissa Tomei, like, realizes, like, something is up and starts investigating, like, where the hell did these people come from? Because none of this was happening hours ago. And so there's a really brief detour into, like, the conspiracy behind the purge. And she's like, I am going to, if I just get proof that this thing is rigged, I can
put
cancel the entire
drive.
Thing. Yeah, just give me that footage. I'm gonna show the world, and that's gonna cancel the purge, and that's gonna stop the new founding fathers. I just need the evidence, and I just need to get it out there. And she does not realize the danger she's in. She does not realize how far, like, this thing's already locked in, right? Like, this night's going to be a success one way or another. Her plan is actually a pretext for, like, what amounts to ethnic cleansing.
Yeah.
And so she basically, like, you know, exits with the new founding father overseer, kind of catches her and ends up dumping her at a gas station, and she's executed. But I think where this kind of ends up is that, like, there are a lot of people who, for a lot of different reasons, love to pathologize different segments of American society and their lived experience. Mm-hmm. And, you know, what is wrong with just, and then X, Y group here. And she's kind of the apotheosis of that character type, right? Like,
yeah.
You know, the best, most open-minded Charles Murray Mengele that you can possibly get. And in the end, like, she's consumed by the thing she's unleashed, and she realizes she's just been a tool of this the entire time. And I think that's where it moves into a new phase, right? Like, the first Purge to this point has been like, this is an experiment. And I think the rest of the movie, what happens after she's made her discovery and the sort of the reveal of, like, what's happened to the church, is where we get to the text of the other films, particularly Anarchy, particularly Election Year, which is, this is just, like, masked ethnic cleansing. This is just masked, like, outright class and race warfare. And, like, I like that pivot. Because I think it does set up this really terrifying denouement, as you mentioned, Austin, with the, like, these scenes of domestic life, these places that were, like, lived in locations at the start, turned into scenes of absolute carnage by the end, and they are invaded.
Yeah, there is a part of that. One of the things that when I was watching it, I was trying to work through was that there is some degree of a vagueness around the makeup of these groups that are coming in. We know they're mercenaries. We know that some of them aren't speaking English. Some of them are. We know that they are dressed like KKK members, like Gestapo officers,
like
cops, like white supremacists, you know, one percenter, biker gangs. And we don't know what the makeup is of people who are wearing that stuff because that's their shit and wearing that stuff because they were told to. Regardless, one of the things that I think is fascinating about this is we see again and again the ways in which this is being covered by the media. We see ways in which, like, Purge HQ is sending out footage. And I couldn't help but think about the ways in which in the world of the Purge, if you are a white supremacist in Philadelphia that night, if you are a white supremacist in Virginia, in Oregon, if you are a sovereign citizen, if you are a militiaman patrolling the border and self-appointed to keep things the way they should be, what a boost the footage of these groups acting out legally on Purge night would be, that there is a propagandistic purpose for whether or not these are groups, whether or not they brought in these groups who had these beliefs already, or whether they were deploying mercenaries to use with those masks on specifically to terrorize that local community and also to embolden the groups that would already be eager to perform that sort of ethnic cleansing.
Right. But they were never identified by the news or media as they just called them gangs.
Yeah.
Because the first ones that came out were supposed to look like gang members. Like they were like they were saying that they were dressed to look like us, and but they were like wearing masks so you couldn't see that they were just like
the first ones that come across are the bikers who have the crosses and shit and go to the
but I mean
church.
The first ones that are talked about on the news. And then they're just referred to as gangs for the rest of the time.
It's flattened out.
Which like if you're seeing the fucking glasses or the lenses,
the contacts,
you can see the fucking the hoods, like you can see this shit. You know, it's like they're purposefully identifiable.
Gang violence, Natalie. Oh, it's a shame. Gang violence.
So this feels so... Sorry, Natalie.
No, go ahead.
Okay. This feels so direct to me of the, like, shitty rhetoric, like, conservative Republican rhetoric that goes directly into these actions, that directly incites this sort of thing. So, like, the scene that, Rob had set up, Mr. Republican guy goes, "We both know there's no easy answer where somebody, some group doesn't suffer." And then white scientist lady who voted for Trump immediately is like, "What have I done?" She immediately says, "What have I done?" It's one of those where it's like immediately like, okay, the white woman who voted for Trump, you know, she thinks there's some problems. She thinks maybe here's a solution to some problems. And then she votes for Trump. And then we get a situation like ICE detaining young children. And we see those videos coming out. Like, it feels to me so of a piece of like what's going on politically. And it's not subtle. It's not necessarily the most, you know, under the skin kind of thing, but it is like this really obvious sort of one-to-one between this violent rhetoric that the conservative right spouts to this sort of thing actually happening, to that propaganda actually happening, actually sort of coming alive in the world, and the white lady who betrayed everyone being like, "What have I done?" and fainting on her couch kind of thing. Like, it felt like that for me.
So for the question about these groups, where'd they come from? Are they Klan? Are they mercenaries? Are they... I think this movie's savvy enough to know this movie, I think, is aware enough of its moment and what is happening in the world to know that that is increasingly a distinction without a difference.
Yes.
That, like, yes. We live, 100%. Like, this is the thing. American, like, right-wing, reactionary, neo-Confederate culture has become internationalized. Mm-hmm. Like, it is, the signs and symbols of those movements are being adopted around the world and co-opted to basically, like, provide the same visual language for the same kind of structural oppression and ethnic violence, just adapted to different circumstances, right? So, like, you know, like, literally in the Brazilian election, they just had, like, the right was adopting very, like, the right was adopting, like, very Trumpist talking points, but then there were also, like, extremist, like, militia groups out there, you know, going to the polls, armed to the teeth, shit like that. Eastern Europe, we're having a similar issue where there's a lot of like neo-fascist groups sort of back on the rise. They've already, you know, taken over a couple countries. And so I think with this, like, I don't think we're meant to get caught up on this question of is this the real Klan or is it not? Because at this point, the real Klan is like internationalized.
Right.
Right? Like, you, like, they will make, like, the American Klan will make common cause and has connections to basically, you know, Klan Bucharest.
Right.
Shit like that. Totally. Like, and so if you want, like, plausible deniability, like, these people can be imported, and a lot of them fit into this already existing ecosystem of international, like, private military contractors.
This, I think, is clearest with the head, like, SS-looking Merc, who's, like, ordering people around inside of the Park Hill Tower, who removes his mask to reveal his face, right? Who, like, the camera wants you to see his face. He, as a person, is like, "I belong here. My face is more important than yours. You should see it." And he's definitely, like, an actor who was cast for this. It was, like, cookie cutter perfect, like, Aryan
Ken doll
face. Like, this is this is what Aryan perfection looks like. Straightens his hat, you know, straightens out his black leather trench coat, and, like, shiny black
patent leather.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh. And you're right, Rob, that, like, what is being communicated partially there is that if you're going to dress up like this, if this is going to be the thing you're going to take, you're already complicit and into the power structures, at least, that allow those things to happen. There's no such thing as a neutral mercenary when the ones in power, the ones who can employ those mercenaries. Sorry to Solid Snake or to Big Boss, who desperately wanted there to be a world where mercenaries could just fight forever. But you can't have neutral mercenaries in a world in which there are power dynamics at play, because they will fundamentally be on the side of whoever it is has the money and those who are aligned there with. And in this case, it is white supremacists. And I think, to double back on the thing that you said about violence and the way violence is shot earlier, Rob, and the ways in which there's a distinct difference between the room-to-room cleansing that's happening inside of the tower versus the more stylized violence outside with Dee's gang. You also see that in just the way people are shot in this movie. This is a movie in which black skin is really beautiful. There are some shots towards the end here, especially during the alarm sequence where we're pivoting the kind of like on a slow cycle between the alarm bright light and then the building having no light at all. And Dee's face and like skin is just it's gorgeous. Yeah. Like it's really shot well. Naya shot well throughout the entire movie. And when you see instead like the white face, first of all, like the pasty white faces of all of the New Founding Fathers people inside of their HQ, that place is shot poorly. They all look pasty. They all look unhealthy. They all look like flat and there's no texture to their skin. They look like they've been caked in very flat, unflattering makeup.
Yeah.
Likewise for like the Aryan super soldier who's walking around in the tower. Like he looks like a supervillain. He looks ugly on the screen. And not just ugly like a bad guy. Not ugly the way Skeletor looks. Like Skeletor is made to look ugly. But even Skeletor is made to look aesthetically interesting to look at in a way that...
There's like a design.
There's a design element. Yeah. Right, totally. There's a like a resolution of aesthetic, if that makes sense. Those are high resolution characters.
Yeah.
They all have features that are important to understand and see. They're not flattened down the way most of the white characters here are, which is, again, something that we don't often talk or think about in filmmaking. But should.
God, I fucking love the sequence as Dee goes into the towers. Because, first of all, this is where it actually flips, where it does begin, like, he begins moving what we'd recognize as, like, tactically, right? Like, he's clearing corners.
He does, yes.
Like we're out of the gun kata equilibrium phase of the movie. But it's done in this context of, well, it's teamwork now, right? Like, upstairs, they are arranging the final defense of the apartment. And it's about like plans, like what, like who's going to do what. And Dee is taking on massively like superior forces. And what's going to save him here is like discipline, smarts, and his skills that he's been preparing, right? This is why, like, why did we see him in a boxing gym earlier? It wasn't just to shout out Avon Barksdale.
No, but it's also his knowledge of the housing project itself.
Right.
Like, it's his, he knows this building. Like, that's what he says to the team before they all
get droned,
are killed, all get droned, is like, we know this, we know, they don't know these halls, they don't know, like, the stairs, they don't know any, like, we know this.
And that's the funny contrast to, like, that the first Purge movie, which was, like, one of our criticisms, was like, you live in this house, and you don't act like you do.
I have a better understanding, like, of this whole building than I had as the layout of that first movie, the first house.
Yeah. Right, where it's like, no one's going to expect that you're going to be, like, a competent fighter, like, that you're not equipped for the situation, but you would at least have a better sense of, like, where a sense of place where you should go, what you should do to give you some mild advantage over the invader. And like, that's what this movie like smartly recognizes, is that like, no, these people should know this. This should give them some sort of tactical advantage. And like, Dimitri is able to use that and leverage that in a way that's, you know, exaggerated, but for the sake of the filmmaking, but like the character is believable. And like, the things they're pulling off at least like feel in time with a character who like should be able to get at least a pounce on these characters because they've been to this place a million times.
Got that. Fight in the stairwell landing is just shot so close. I don't know how the camera is moving around.
It's deeply uncomfortable. Yeah. Like, it's claustrophobic in a way that, like, when you, like, as Rob, you're saying, like, when you think about the technical way it should have, how it would have been filmed, it's just like, that doesn't make any sense. But the way they pull it off makes you just feel like you're in the middle of that.
When he throws that fucking like, that Nazi sequence over the camera, basically, like, in your face, and, like, it's like the eclipse happening in front of you. That guy was flying down the stairwell. It is so good and satisfying. And then him choking the shit out of that guy. It's great.
Yeah.
And then I love when they cut the power. Like, the fucking flickering floodlights and that moment of, like, people are starting to go radio silent, and it's that moment you see that moment the fear start to hit that assault team.
Yeah.
As it starts to dawn on them, like, oh shit, like, the lights are out, we don't belong here, this isn't our space, and things are not going according to plan. It's a great moment. It is the moment, like, the power dynamic flips, and it's like, nope, this is a home game.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, he says he chokes out this guy. He rips the mask off to reveal the white face, blonde hair, blue eyes, and says, "Fuck out of my neighborhood."
Yeah.
Like, yeah, D, what's good? Let's go. Yeah. I'm ready to come in with you.
Put me in, coach.
Put me in. And then they do, right? Because to some degree, the big final confrontations is it isn't just D clearing house. It does come down to, all right, here is our plan to protect our apartment.
Yeah.
Like, I'm going to hide behind this door with this gun with 5 bullets in it. Y'all are going to have knives. They're going to come in. I'm going to shoot them in their knees. They're going to fall down, and then you're going to stab them to death. And then that just happens. It just works. Like, yes.
Well, the articulation of the plan is an interesting point, because often that isn't – you don't get that moment where, like, the people involved actually say, this is what we're
instead,
going to do.
Instead, what you get is the people in the theater going, like, man, what I would do is I would get the gun. Right. You two would get the knives. I'd shoot them in the ankles. They'd fall down. Then you'd stab them. And that definitely happened in this movie theater. Well, and then they did the damn thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Naya knows they've got body armor, and she's like, ankles, knees, do not stab them in the chest, cut their fucking throats.
We finally
Isaiah,
got it.
For the first time tonight, you need to keep your shit together and actually fucking cut a guy. Like, you gotta do it.
And it's not a bad thing. It's not a bad thing to kill fascists. It isn't. It's not. Isaiah's soul didn't get lost in the process. Like, these people are going from room to room, killing everyone they can.
Yeah.
Fight back.
Yeah. The one thing that was surprising to me is that none of these mercs were geared up with night vision goggles.
They didn't know.
I remember writing that down. I was like,
yeah.
So the Purge takes place at night.
They had step one, night vision.
But I mean, all the other Purge. I guess from this point on, they learned. They were like, all right, this was the first one.
True.
This is the first one.
You just got to get.
When the new founding fathers had their post-mortem meeting, it's like, all right.
What went wrong?
What would have done better? You know, some notes. I want to say, first of all, great job on the costume design. Just fantastic. But one thing, if you could incorporate night vision goggles into the KKK hoods, I think that would serve a dual purpose.
I know it's going to be bulky. It's going to be bulky. But aesthetically, it's not going to be as pleasing.
You know,
but,
bring
your
power parade.
Oh, my God.
God.
And I guess, like, that scene, you know, that you're describing, Austin, about the talking about the plan, the executing of the plan, and also the idea of, like, pushing back against, like, this invasion. Like, this movie, like, sort of rhetorically and thematically, like, undercuts, like, everything election year is saying, in which, like, election year's argument, you know, that it articulates through its characters and, like, you know, its aspiring presidential candidate is that, like, no, like, we can't be like them. We can't participate. Mm-hmm. We need to be better than them, and we just need to vote and believe in the system, and we can turn these things around. And, like, this movie, like, which, you know, takes place, you know, before all this stuff, but, like, advances the argument in a different direction and basically says, like, actually fuck them, take to the streets, grab a weapon, and, like, put a bullet in them. And it's just, like, a really, really, and I wonder, and again, like, we can't pull this apart, I wonder how much of that comes from the director versus, like, DeMonico. He's like, I have a hard time believing that DeMonico said, like, I'm going to write a prequel that is going to thematically undercut the argument I was making at the end of the last movie. Whereas, like, you see all the little touches in this film that, like, it's the reason I wanted to mention that interview where the director is finding ways to, like, sharpen and, like, punch up this script and, like, what it's saying. And I certainly feel like this movie, at the absence of DeMonico, is, like, coming up with, like, a better argument for actually what you should do about the Purge, which is not to just believe in making the system better. It's actually fuck the system, burn it, and build a new one.
Yeah, there's one line when Dimitri is confronting what's his name, the Brutus of the group. Who is that what you're going to talk about?
Yeah.
So there's this whole subplot where one of Dimitri's members of his gang decides, like, nope, you know what? This is my house now. I'm the king now. I'm going to try and take over the gang for myself. But when Dimitri, like, foils his plan, he says something so specific. He says, this is their Purge. Like, this is, like references a third party. Mm-hmm. And then he says, you try to purge. no, I purge or something like that, which was like so. At first, I was like, yeah, yeah, it's theirs. It's theirs. Like, you're talking about how your part, what you are doing is not participating in this night. Mm-hmm. You are like, this is a different thing. This is not the purge. But then he says, I purge. And then he's in the car with, I think it's Kells or I forget.
It's with Seven, I think. Isn't
it? Is it with Seven?
Yeah.
And says, like, I guess I purge or something like that, and like is like fuck that shit or something.
I found that I have the script, which okay, is just perfect. To read it, just for you.
Thank you.
He says, "Young King, your time is up now. A, it was short. Hope the crown fell good." And he's like, "Yo, D, you thought that you could use their purge to take my ass out? Yeah. Didn't anybody tell you, A? I don't know how to die. You can't purge me, man. I purge you in plain sight." And that cuts to the thing you're saying, mm-hmm. which is in the car. In the car, he's like making fun of it.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, 100%.
I think this is just like.
But when he says "I purge you," it is not
I'm purging.
It is
right.
I purge you from my fucking group.
In plain sight, yeah, I don't need the purge.
Thank you for reading that. That
is what he's saying.
Yeah,
he's
saying
like I don't need the purge to kill people. I am the kingpin in this area.
Yeah.
I kill who I want to kill.
Yeah.
And then he does that thing.
Yeah.
Again, he is a blaxploitation hero, 100%.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
And also, this is still a Demonico script.
Right.
This is still like, look, you know, here's the thing. I really like The Wire. I really like blaxploitation films. I need a gangland succession war subplot into this movie, and we're just going to shoehorn it in there. And, like, is anyone going to refer to it before or after? Absolutely not. Like, but I need my equivalent of you take a shot at the king.
Best not miss.
You best not miss. Uh-huh. I need that, and then we're going to move on from it. And it is such a weird, like, it also, like, this is D. Like, D's a bad dude.
Yeah.
But, like... We kind of just throw that aside because it's like, well, that guy fucking sucked. And like, anyway, D's the only person taking care of the community. So if that means he's got to execute like a half dozen people in an alley somewhere.
So at the very, very end of the movie, it's D and Naya who are sort of walking out, right? She's sort of helping him walk out. Dolores, I'm sure we could talk about Dolores at some point too. She's kind of there to be funny.
She is the auntie of this movie, 100%.
She's the auntie. She has a very funny poop joke earlier.
Very funny ass eating.
I always appreciate, you know, a little bit.
She
does have a very good ass eating joke. She's
she's
funny.
She's like
tastes like old man. Yeah.
She's like this. Like
don't ask me how I know.
Tastes like old man ass.
Don't ask me how I know. And I was like, girl, you crazy.
Yeah. She was like Dolores.
I think Dolores and the pastor actually have a little thing. That's my read.
Honestly,
I think
she
knows
where
you know.
She knew where his liquor was. That's right.
And what is ass?
And what is
like?
Ass
so
taste like?
I'm just
that's
gonna
all
say,
I'm saying.
You know, like there's intimacy there. Let's just
anyway,
put it
that
tell
way. Me. Dang, yeah. About the touching conclusion.
Yeah, sorry.
Let's give it all the
sorry.
Way.
You know, it feels like maybe a little cheesy, but it does feel like a touching conclusion in some ways, or at least the way I read it on its surface of like Kingpin with a Heart of Gold, aka like the guy just straight out of Gang Leader for a Day. But with the community activists, and they're together, like the two of them, and people are like fist bumping both of them and saying like, thank you, and saying thank you, D, but they're also saying thank you, Naya, and then Kendrick's All Right kind of comes on at the end. So like, again, this might be a little cheesy, it might be a little much, but it did feel like, okay, we've got two different approaches to making things better in the community. One is very clearly both helping and hurting the community, and one is just very clearly trying to help the community, but with mixed results. And, like, together, they've come together to try to save the neighborhood, and then we play the music. You know, it's... I don't
gotta
know how other people read it, but it...
Community theater or whatever. Gotta save the community center.
More after-school programs.
Right?
I got, actually... The end of this movie was frustrating to me because this is the first purge. This shit's gonna happen for, like, 18 more years. This shit's not gonna be all right. Like, this community.
Listen, maybe Staten Island is all right, though. Maybe D locks it down. He's like, no purging ever again.
Staten Island
is
just
my AU for this.
I appreciate that. But that was such a weird moment for me to hear Kendrick Lamar's All Right come on in that moment and to have this, like, like congratulatory, like, yes, you survived tonight. And but immediately, and you know what's fucked up is like as All Right is playing, they interstitch like the fucking William Williamson talking about how he's like, it was a great success. We're going to spread this to the rest of the United States. Everyone can participate. And All Right is just still, and like, maybe it is supposed to be like that kind of like, but it missed for me where I just felt like the thing that I was curious is like, I was curious if this movie was going to have like a Carmelo like pre-plot or if there was going to be like instances of, or in the end plot that there was going to be like showing kind of like the formation of some revolution.
Yeah, there could have, even if it was just like cut in with like some sort of like montage of like, well, and here's how the revolution was built in response to the first purge, or like some sort of thing where it's like, it's reasonable to think that like there are communities that reject the purge and just like insulate themselves, right? Like,
what if Dimitri,
of the first purge, builds up and says like, actually, no, not Staten Island, right? Like, it would make sense that like stuff like that would occur, and a way of like cutting that in with the montage of like, oh, the purge is going to occur. Like, would
but
have they
been already
like,
know
to show
they
the
already
undercurrent.
Know that the government is the one sending fucking mercs to clear them out. Like, they already know that on the first fucking night, on the first time.
Yeah.
And so you are not up against like your fellow community members. You are already up against the government. You already know that. You've already been up against the government.
That's what I was going to say. Like, these are also people who know, who already, the reason they are able to put it together so quick is they've been up against the government their whole lives, right?
Yeah.
And I think that's the thing for me. That's why I think it's super cheesy. I think, like, if I would have loved another couple passes on the last, like, scene here in the draft to try to find something else. But, like, All Right, the Kendrick song isn't like, and from now on we're okay. Like, that is not what that song is.
No.
Like, Kendrick, when for me, that song doesn't mean, and that's it, we saved the day.
No,
it means, like, we're going to fucking drag each other through this thing, and we're gonna push through it. It might take 18 years.
Yeah.
It might take a whole other lifetime to get there, but we can do that thing. And and it's not about success. It's about a commitment to continuing.
Yeah.
I do think it's cheesy. I would have loved to have seen any of the things you just said addressed in terms of, like, I would have loved to have seen, like, some like teenage Carmelo happened to be there.
Yeah,
like, you know, I would have fucking loved that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But I also I don't think this is the last Purge movie. I don't think they were thinking about this as the final Purge movie.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't be surprised if we also get a movie called The Last Purge at some point.
Mm-hmm. Well, they said to set up like where the Purge is at in its mythology.
Right.
Midway through the credits on this film is a tease for the TV series, which was premiering a couple of months later. They just renewed the TV series for a second season, and then they announced that they're doing a final Purge movie that will bring the story to a close. So, yes, like, it wouldn't be surprising if the last movie was just called The Last Purge.
I'm curious. I am not going to watch that TV series because I hear it's terrible.
Nope.
But if people say the second season's good, I'll watch them both because I'm a fucking fool. Because I'm all in now.
I think, for me, one of the things, like, it has sort of a feel-goodish ending, but I think the thing the movie just cannot resolve is that on some level it wants to be on Team Naya. It wants to be like, D, you know, you've learned, you got to give back to the community, you got to take care of your people. But, like, literally, he had those guns because he financed it with drugs.
Yep.
Literally, this movie. And also, Naya has to basically shit-can her whole, like, plan A. By plan B, it's the fucking, like, military, the fucking tactical skills that she, like, practiced with D. Like, she's, like, putting people down with a fucking hand cannon.
Yeah.
And so this movie tries to end with, like, well, we're going to rebuild. We're going to put this neighborhood back together. But also, like, what the movie's text has shown us, like, throughout this is, like, if you're going to protect this, you need D and his crew of pals to be, like, armed to the freaking teeth.
Yeah.
Right? You know what I mean? Like, there's no, like, you're not going to ride this one out at home or at church. Like, you need, like, basically that whole, like, peaceful protest resistance, passive resistance, that's not going to fucking work. You need to be able to fight back. And
the good guy with the gun.
Yeah. And so I think this movie kind of struggles because, like, it wants to be, like, D's learned something. The wise men are there at the end. We're going to put this all back together. Literally, all of this is possible because there was a drug gang / militia in the neighborhood.
Rob, in chat, you say we forgot a subplot.
No, that was the thing Natalie brought up.
Yeah,
oh,
the one that...
Okay, thank God. I was like, wait, yeah. Did we forget another subplot? Fuck.
We might have.
I mean, probably. I mean, I want to be clear. I think we're all kind of heaping some fondness onto this movie. I think it's so much better than Election Year. Yeah. That's a big part of it.
Yeah.
It might be my favorite of...
I think it's my favorite.
It might be my favorite of these. It's up there. I have to...
If Carmelo was in it, it would be my favorite.
That's all it takes. Carmelo was barely in two is the problem.
I know, but he was just so good.
He was very good.
I mean, I think this one is the most effective at wrestling.
Yes. But
with,
it is so card
like the politics.
It is so cards on the table. Like it is so like, if you haven't gotten it by now, this is what the fuck is going
here
on.
It is.
Like here it is on a platter for you to eat and read.
Yes.
There it is.
There it is. But I will say the like I'm so much happier with it trying to contend with this stuff, but also as a film, like it has some issues. I do think I like the wise men a lot. I really do. But also they are the most like, what's good, old G? Like, oh, you're still around? Oh, the three wise men are here? Well, you know, we've seen some things in our time. We know how it is. We're the wise men. We've been here for a long time.
Just like, kidding. We're the three stooges.
Right, we're the three stooges, right. And Jerry Curl. And it's I'm fine with those. I'm fine with it because I actually think this is just a really, really good B movie.
Mm-hmm.
And it has no pretenses at being... at being something else, where like the original Purge film, absolutely, it's a B movie still in its own way, but like, this is like high tension,
the high mind,
exactly. Yeah. Which is like, no, like we're leaning in and we're gonna do that as well as we can. And so I still think there are some vestiges of that style of filmmaking around, like just dropped in exposition around some internal inconsistencies.
Well, it's all DeMonico, right? Like I think like the lost, like seeing what this director brought to this movie and what he was able to punch mm-hmm. up, and probably the things that we'll never know that he punched up. It's there was a lot more that could have been done with this series if it was handed off to other people, right? Like it would have been, there are so many smart ways to have gone with this series that I think were ultimately hamstrung by DeMonico being the creative force. Like he sort of stumbled into something that could have been a lot more interesting. Like imagine had this continued to be an anthology series that like you didn't just at the end bring in a person of color to direct, but like the writing staff were people of color. Like there were just so many. This could have been, it could have had its cake and eat its too. Like it could have still just had the exploitative fun action sequences, but done so much more in the character and world building that just DeMonico was clearly not equipped to wrestle with. And had this movie at some point had a co-writer or been given over to other writers, I just think there's a lot of missed opportunity with the premise. And it's the first Purge, I think, gets as close as like it could have gotten in a lot of ways to doing what it could, with DeMonico being the person who is sort of underwriting, you know, what's actually and mm-hmm. there.
DeMonico's next movie, Once Upon a Time in Staten Island, which seems to be...
Really?
That's what it's called.
I thought
not
that
a
was
joke.
A joke.
What's it about?
I for real thought
it's,
that was a joke.
It's
right
out
there.
In 2019, and so I'm having a hard time seeing it, but it's like, it's Frank Grillo. It's the Punisher guy again.
Okay.
Naomi Watts, uh-huh. He's writing a movie with Naomi Watts, is going to be in that movie. So the title for me makes me think, like, coming of age, like, maybe mob movie. That's just reading the title. That's all that is. I don't know. We'll see.
Anyway.
The thing that you said, though, is important, which is the director of the first Purge is doing a segment for an episode of Twilight Zone, of Jordan Peele's upcoming Twilight Zone.
Nice.
And so that
I'm curious. Like, he clearly has an eye, like Jordan Peele, for finding ways to... you know, Twilight Zone was a very political show. People just don't remember it that way. And like, he's a good choice, given what he did with the first Purge, to bring into whatever that thing is going to be from Jordan Peele. So I'm excited to see more of that. I want to go back and watch that hazing film that the director did. Apparently it's just on Netflix. So I'm curious to see more of that. But yeah, we're not going to watch the Purge TV series. I think like this is a good way to end our viewing of the Purge. If for some reason you've watched that series and like there's like something interesting about it, like I'd be like, hit me up on Twitter. Like I would watch an episode if like there is like something interesting to check out. But there's a lot of good things to watch these days, and I don't need to watch a mediocre
There's so much good stuff.
Show. But we don't know what we're going to do next for this rewatch podcast. So if you have ideas, if you have thoughts, like, well, I guess people should just keep writing into what? GamingAdvice.com. That's the one email we have. Yeah. It's right into GamingAdvice.com with your suggestions. Like, we are going to spend some time thinking about what we want to watch next. Whether it doesn't have to be a series. Like, this ended up being a series.
Could be a beloved
mini-series.
Kind of
around Halloween. Yeah, could be. Yeah. Like, we're pretty open on what exactly that's all. Oh, are you already pitching something, Rob? Uh-huh. What was it?
Oh, just, the iconic and deeply influential BBC Pride and Prejudice.
Oh, right.
It's a good. It's a great series. I want to be clear. I've seen it. I love it.
Yeah, not...
It's great.
So if you have ideas or you want to support Rob's ideas, please write in to gamingadvice.com. I want to... Natalie? Danielle, you're saying Natalie has a thing?
She's asking if calling Staten Island the island
is that
a thing?
They do it a lot in the movie. They're like, get off the island. This is my island.
It is an island.
But is that a thing?
I don't know that I know anyone from Staten Island.
As being someone who just moved to
Staten
New York
Island's
a few
weird.
Years ago,
Staten
I don't know
There was that guy
from
who worked
island.
The door at Vice, the security guy.
That was
from
Staten
Island.
He's from Staten Island.
He's from Staten Island.
Do you think he calls it the island? I was just curious because I'd...
Please write in.
Yeah,
let us know.
Please write in.
Wu-Tang Clan, the island lyrics. I'm going to find out. Because if they do, they would have called it that at some point.
We'll do some research.
Started off on the island, a.k.a. Shaolin. Yeah, that's how how Can It Be All So Simple starts. So yeah, right. Solved. Done.
Solved.
Did it.
And that's going to solve this podcast. You can follow everything I do. At Patrick Club, you can follow everything Waypoint does at waypoint.vice.com. Natalie, where can people follow you?
At Natalie Watson on Twitter.
Austin.
Austin _Walker. Yeah. Also on Twitter. That's where. I'm also on Mastodon. You find me at content.town. I barely post there, but that's where I stay. AKA the island, AKA Shaolin, AKA New Drews. You already know what it is. Dedicated to all the winners and the losers. Dedicated to all the Jeeps and Land Cruisers. You know.
What it is.
That's what it
Danielle.
Is.
How do I follow that up?
You don't.
At Danielle R.I.
Rob.
At Rob Zachney on Twitter.com, a social media network reborn.
Blessed be Jack.
Blessed be the.
No, I can't even.
We need to purge your likes because that's what was toxic about this platform.
God.
Purge the Nazis, Jack. Purge them.
That's going to do it. We'll see you. I don't know. We don't have a schedule. We'll just see you. There'll be another podcast.
Bye.
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 Patrick, I really feel you stuck the landing there. Like, you might second guess yourself afterwards, but I want to assure you, like, nailed it.
Thank you. Thank you.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile. And the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time. There's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.